Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The summer of 1982, what a great time to be a science fiction fan going to the movies because there were so many great sci-fi films released that season. Today, it seems incredible that this batch, including E.T., Tron, Star Trek, Wrath of Khan, Conan the Barbarian, Blade Runner, Poltergeist, The Thing, and Mad Max Road Warrior, were all released within 6 weeks of one another, and each of them stands on its own as a classic of the genre. So how was Hollywood able to produce these eight films that still hold up today, capture our imagination, and have launched careers and sequels and so much more? There's a new book out, The Future Was Now. The author is Chris Nashaway, and he tells the story of how these films came to be. And Chris, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to talk about these fun films. And I do want to start off by playing a scene from the film E.T., The Extraterrestrial. This is a scene that takes place in the room of the young boy, played by Henry Thomas. And when he shows E.T. to his siblings, and then the mom comes in. I think there's a lot in this little scene about that kind of explains what goes on in the entire movie, and I really love it, so let's give a listen to it.
I have absolute power. Say it.
Say it!
What have you got? Is it the coyote?
No. Look. Okay. Now, swear it. The most excellent promise you can make. Swear as my only brother on our lives.
Don't get so heavy, I swear.
Okay, stand over there, and you'd better take off your shoulder.
What?
You might scare him. And close your eyes.
Don't push it, Elliot.
I'm not coming out there until your eyes are closed.
Okay, they're closed. I'm just gonna kill you.
Okay, swear it one more time. I have absolute...
You have absolute power. Yes.
What happened in here?
Oh, you mean my room.
This is no room. This is an accident.
And the actress looks straight into the camera and says, this is an accident. And she's not just talking about the room, but so much more. And the fact that the older brother invokes Yoda is also important, you know, in just capturing the time. So, Chris, tell me about, you know, the making of E.T. and how it was such a tremendous hit.
Yeah, it's obviously, even listening to it right now, it's just a reminder of how much heart and fun is in this movie. This is a movie that, you know, it was Spielberg's first movie after he had made Raiders of the Lost Ark. So he was on quite a hot streak, but E.T. would take it to a different level completely. It became, you know, the top grossing movie of all time. But, you know, it grew out of his childhood. Spielberg is someone who taps into his own life over and over again in his movies. And this one is sort of reflects the kid that he was. He sort of felt like an outsider and an ugly duckling. He, you know, grew up in a home where his parents split up, and I think he felt lonely. And he created sort of pretend make-believe friends. And E.T. is really sort of a look back at that time of childhood, growing up in a broken home, and really sort of looking for a connection, looking for a friend. And it just happens to be an alien. So it's a great movie. I remember seeing it in the summer of 1982 when I was 13. And, you know, back then it was certainly my favorite of the bunch as a 13-year-old.
Yeah, so that's what's interesting to me. We have new generations watching these films and discovering them for the first time, and they're experiencing it in their own context. And now when they see it, it's almost, you know, doing some archaeology of like what was life in 1982 like. But when we saw it for the very first time, it was informing us about ourselves and the lives that we were living in a way that other films really had not done before.
Yeah, I mean, E.T. is a really, if you look, on one level, it's just a really entertaining, heartwarming tale about a kid and his friend, and it's a lovely sort of fairy tale. But on a deeper level, it is really, you know, it's a deep movie. It's got a lot going on in it. It's about suburbia. It's about the Reagan era. It's about, you know, optimism and hope. There were a lot of sci-fi movies that came out during this summer in 1982 that were made in the wake of Star Wars' success. And a lot of them are a little bit mean and nasty, but E.T. was the one that was hopeful and positive and, you know, kinder and gentler. And, you know, it's not surprising that that's the one that was the biggest hit out of all of them.
So when it seems like Spielberg is tipping the hat to Star Wars when he invokes Yoda and, you know, the young man talking. And then later when we talk about Poltergeist, you know, the closet that opens up and starts sucking everything into it, right next to that closet is a poster of Darth Vader. So you could just see that, you know, that Spielberg was showing that, yeah, this is all because of the success of Star Wars.
Yeah, and Spielberg and Lucas were, you know, best friends at the time. And, you know, they had just made Raiders of the Lost Ark together. They sort of came up in the Hollywood industry together. They were friends, not just professionally, but personally. And it's interesting that right after George Lucas had made Star Wars, and while Steven was working on Close Encounters, they took a vacation together to get away from the madness of Star Wars's opening, and they went to Hawaii. And it was there, while they were making sandcastles on the beach, that they sort of made the agreement to do Raiders of the Lost Ark together. So their history goes back, and they certainly were the two most iconic, popular directors of that time. And yes, they would make little nods to each other in their movies.
All right, so we're going to take a break here, but our phone lines are open. We do want to hear from listeners about your experiences going to these films in 1982. What a smorgasbord of cinematic fun and creativity and experimentation. Why don't we have that today? But call in. Tell us what you thought about these movies then and now. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. When we come back, we've got Randall. We'll get you on the board. We'll get you on the air when we come right back from this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
The house looks just like the one next to it. And the one next to that. And the one next to that. A young couple live in it.
Give Ken a kiss.
You are so obnoxious.
With their three children.
Of course, honey. Chew each bite 10 times.
And something more.
Hello.
you remember when you woke up and you said you're here?
Uh-huh.
Well, who did you meet? Who's here?
TV people.
Something's funny going on here next door. Something,
We were wondering if maybe you had experienced any disturbances lately.
What kind of disturbances?
I don't know whatever's over this house. I've never sensed anything like it.
That thing is in there with my baby!
They're hungry.
Now Steven Spielberg crosses a frightening new threshold into a world within our own. Its form is revealed.
What is it?
Its focus is clear. And the games are over. Poltergeist. It knows what scares you.
Source on Texas Public Radio, and David Martin Davies. We're talking about the science fiction films released of 1982. So many big hits. Some of them weren't hits, but they have certainly have had an impact over the years. Speaking with the author of the book, The Future Was Now, Chris Nashawaty. And so, Chris, Poltergeist, it's also a takedown, an examination of life in the suburbs. It seems like there's a theme of you don't really know what's going on in the house next door. And what's going on inside can be just absolutely bonkers and astounding. But so how did Steven Spielberg in this one summer come up with two hit films? And then he himself became a brand because they branded the film of, you know, Steven Spielberg's Poltergeist. So he was the summer of Steven Spielberg in many ways.
It really was. In fact, back then, that's exactly what they called it. It he was coming off of Jaws and Close Encounters and Raiders of the Lost Ark. You could not have been a more successful, more popular, more name brand Hollywood director than Steven Spielberg at the time, and frankly, still. But in 1982, he was responsible for two movies during the summer. And Poltergeist was the second one to E.T. Poltergeist, they grew out of the same idea. Spielberg had wanted to make a movie, tell a story about an alien visitation. And part of that became E.T. And part of that became Poltergeist, which was, you know, it over the development process, it went from being a story about aliens to about the paranormal, supernatural. And but they really were sort of like an embryo that split into twins. And one was sort of the good twin and one was the evil twin. One was a positive story and one was sort of a horror chiller. And so they really did grow out of the same idea, the same impulse to tell this story. But what's interesting is that, you know, because of the Directors Guild has rules saying that, you know, you cannot direct two movies at the same time. You know, Spielberg had to give up the reins on Poltergeist and was just the co-writer and the producer. The director was actually Tobe Hooper, who had directed the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And you know, there's some speculation still about, you know, who actually directed the movie, who was calling the shots on that movie. It was a little bit of a scandal at the time.
Let's go to a caller. We have Randall on the phone. So the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What was it like for you the summer of 1982 if you were devouring these science fiction films as they were hitting the silver screen along with a lot of popcorn? And Randall, you're on the air.
Well, I wasn't just devouring it. I was feeding you. I was in my very first job, the old Ingram Six Theater that used to be in Ingram Park Mall in San Antonio. And my first night on the job was June 11th, 1982, opening night of E.T. lines everywhere, stretching all the way down to the other end of Ingram Park Mall. Ushers were getting on top of Pac-Man and Donkey Kong to do crowd control, trying to steer people through the lobby. One thing I want to mention about E.T. is that the Ingram Six Theater had basically three sizes of auditoriums. The first three auditoriums sat 300 to 350 people. Auditoriums four and five sat about 180, 190 each. And then the rinky dink auditorium six only sat, you know, like 88, 89 people. This is an era right on the brink of home video. Home video was not yet a thing. Today, a movie comes out and then it's gone in 6 weeks because they want to put it into streaming and DVD and all that stuff. That wasn't the case in 1982. You wanted to keep a hit movie in the theaters as long as possible. By Christmas of 1982, we still had E.T. in the big 350-seat auditorium. It was still playing. By the time E.T. had its very last week at the Ingram Six Theater in the little auditorium number six, 52 weeks had passed. We had E.T. for an entire year. You don't see that anymore in a big theater, and I don't think you ever will again.
Randall, thank you so much for that call and for that the deep background on that. What do you take away from that, Chris?
That's a great story, actually, and it really hits on so many sort of trends that are going on. You know, yeah, he's absolutely 100% correct that movies would play so much longer back then, especially if they were good and people wanted to see them. E.T. was in theaters for a long time. I think it was the number one movie in the country for like 18 weeks or something like that. And they weren't consecutive weeks. I mean, like, this is a movie that, you know, just kept playing and playing and playing. And something new would come out and it would get bumped to number two. But then a couple weeks later, it would go back to number one. It's just a movie that people saw over and over and again. I think, you know, it might be weird for some of your listeners to hear about that sort of pandemonium at a movie theater. We're so sort of divorced from that idea. But yeah, I remember seeing this movie in theaters and it was impossible to get a ticket. And I remember being on lines overnight. I remember staying camping out to see Jurassic Park on opening day. It's just movie going was so much more, critical to so many people. You couldn't guarantee that the movie would play on streaming, you know, a month later. So you really needed to go out there and see it. And, E.T. was a real phenomenon. It was a movie that it not just played to both kids and grownups, but like it was a movie that by the time the end credits were rolling, the theater was a chorus of sobs and sniffles. It was a real phenomenon. And, I think the story that your caller just told really sort of lends into that. But movies have changed so much now. It's impossible to imagine a movie playing not just a year later, but maybe 3 months later. It just doesn't happen.
October 19th, 1985. That's the day that the first Blockbuster store opened in Dallas, Texas. And so that changed everything. Like the caller Randall told us, you know, you didn't have to hold a movie in a theater for a full year. You could go rent it at the time. It changed the meaning of the word Blockbuster, actually.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, I don't want to just use the VHS revolution as something that was negative. It did negatively affect the theatrical experience. But it also was a huge cash infusion for these, you know, and revenue source for these movie studios. And also, I want to point out that it also we think of fan culture now. I mean, in a movie, that's in a way, that's what this book is sort of the moment that it's capturing is sort of the birth of fan culture and Hollywood really listening to that and trying to appeal to that. But, you know, VHS was also great for people who might have lived, you know, in rural areas and wanted to see Blade Runner and couldn't.
Blade Runner was a box office flop. And when it became out on VHS, some of these other movies didn't do that great in the box office either. The Thing, it gave them the public a second look at these films.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way, I like to think of VHS back then as sort of a court of appeals. You know, the movie gets a second chance to find its audience. And it missed it the first time, but sometimes it could find that second life on video. And that certainly happened with some of the movies in this book from the summer of 1982.
But the Blockbuster experience also is something, you know, we no longer have. Let's go to Blockbuster. Let's pick out some movies to watch this weekend. And now, you know, you just turn on the TV and, you know, your smart TV and you just pick them as you go. It's just interesting how that also is a part of the past. That I don't know if it's good or bad or whatever, but it happened.
Yeah, it's different. It's funny. I'm a big music lover, and I compare it to, like, you know, the experience of listening to music on vinyl, on records. You know, when you put on an album, it's a very deliberate sort of thing. You know, you're making a choice and you're sort of saying, this is what I'm going to listen to. It's intentional. Whereas, you know, just going to Spotify and just, you know, saying play shuffle and you have music as a background thing, I'm not saying that's bad, but it's very, very different experience. So I sort of feel like movies have become less intentional in sort of the streaming era. But back in the era that this book chronicles, it was certainly a very intentional thing to do.
Well, were the movies made with that intention? I mean, it seemed like they're still recovering from the shock of Star Wars. And because Hollywood executives were just baffled that they were able to give more creative control to visionaries who were able to produce this batch of incredible films.
Yeah, I mean, it's really an interesting sort of moment of shift in the industry at this time. You know, there was a period in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, so-called New Hollywood, when, you know, young maverick filmmakers, you know, the generation of Martin Scorsese and Robert Altman and Coppola and whatnot, sort of became the new powers in Hollywood. And it was a generational shift. But in the summer of 1982, I would say that the real shift that happened is one where you finally get the studios seeing what happened with Star Wars 5 years earlier and reacting and saying, okay, here's this movie that people aren't just seeing, but seeing over and over and over again.
So it's making a lot of money, and they're willing to take chances and discover new stars and new formats, new ways of entertaining Hollywood, entertaining America. Let's take a break, and we're going to listen to another trailer. This is the one that launched Arnold Schwarzenegger. Let's give a listen.
Warrior. Thief. Gladiator. Conqueror. Conan.
They said you would come. Man of great strength.
I've got a little challenge for you, Sark. A new recruit. He's a tough case, but I want him treated in the usual manner. Train him for the games, let him hope for a while, and blow him away.
You got it. I've been hoping you'd send me somebody with a little bit of guts. What kind of program is he?
He's not any kind of program, Sark. He's a user.
A user?
That's right. He pushed me in the real world. Somebody pushes me, I push back, so I brought him down here. What's the matter, Sark? You look nervous.
Well, I It's just, I don't know, a user. I mean, users wrote us. A user even wrote you.
No one user wrote me. I'm worth millions of their man years.
What if I can't?
You'd rather take your chances with me? Want me to slow down your power cycles for you?
Wait! I need that!
Then pull yourself together. Get this clown trained. I want him in the games until he dies. Play. Acknowledge.
Acknowledge.
And that is from Tron, Disney's entry into the incredible 8 films that came out the summer of 1982. And the number to call if you've got a question or comment, want to tell us about your experiences watching these films, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to a caller. We have Jesse on the phone. And Jesse, you're on the air.
Hi, David. my comment was basically just movies today, they lack originality, number one, but more importantly, I guess we're living in sci-fi today. So today's movie, science fiction, doesn't necessarily draw the attention as it did back in the day, but I'd imagine, or in my opinion, if there were movies more so in the vein of like Netflix's Stranger Things, you'll have a bigger audience because it's harkening back to a day where technology wasn't so prevalent in our lives.
All right, Jesse, thank you for that. I think it's pretty insightful. Appreciate it. So Chris Nashawadi, the author of the book, The Future Was Now, as he writes about the genesis of these 8 films, it seemed like Tron at the time, of course, Disney produced it. And I want to hear you tell the story about how they came about doing that. But also, it seems with AI becoming more and more of a threat or you know, part of our lives, and people are kind of, you know, kind of threatened by that, it does seem to take on more meaning.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, we're definitely living in interesting times right now. It's also interesting that, you know, Disney, when they greenlit Tron, they were also going through some interesting times, not very happy ones. The studio that had been the biggest force in animation in the 40s and 50s, you know, had really fallen on hard times. You know, it wasn't, you weren't going to succeed in Hollywood by just re-releasing Snow White every summer. They knew that they needed to get into this new blockbuster game, you know, that Star Wars and Jaws had created. And it's interesting that you know, George Lucas actually went to Disney to pitch them Star Wars when he was looking for a studio to back it. And Disney passed. They just didn't have a sense of the zeitgeist anymore. They didn't have its finger on the pulse. And so, but they did know that they needed to change and take a big risk and on a sci-fi movie, because that was the new thing after Star Wars. And they got a visit from this filmmaker named Steven Lisberger, who had a new idea. And it wasn't so much the story was a new idea, although it was more the technique that he wanted to make the movie in. He used something called backlit animation, which is sort of a cross between live action and animation, using computers, which at the time was just very expensive and laborious, but very cutting edge. And this movie was almost a little bit too ahead of its time, but Disney rolled the dice. The movie did, you know, pretty much broke even for them, but it was more that it proved that they were willing to sort of get into the action and not just sit on the sidelines anymore. And that's sort of a recurring theme throughout the entire summer of 1982, is that, you know, Hollywood is in this really sort of existential moment. It doesn't know which way to go. And people really took risks, and that's sort of not how studios are acting today.
Well, they say that the movies cost so much to make now that they can't take any risk. That's why they're locked into building these cinematic universes, a lot of sequels, things that are tried and true. You know, you make one John Wick movie, why not make 3?
Yeah, that's almost always a bad idea, I think, that, you know, when you say that something is so expensive that you can't take a risk, well, you should probably maybe rethink the model then. You know, why not make smaller movies that aren't as risky? And the upside is even bigger. I mean, if you're making these giant battleship movies, maybe it's time to go with something smaller and more nimble, where if it doesn't connect, it doesn't bankrupt the studio. And if it does connect, the upside is so massive. I know that that's what's happening. I just think it's sort of that sort of thinking is madness.
Well, that's kind of what happened with Star Trek Wrath of Khan. The first Star Trek movie, as you write about, was a box office disappointment. It cost a lot of money to make. The studios weren't ready to give up on Star Trek just yet, but they said, let's make one more, but this time cheaper, faster, and more excitement. And also they wanted to include the death of Spock, and we're going to listen to a clip with that.
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
No response, Admiral.
Scotty, Mr. Sulu, get us out of here. Best possible speed.
Aye, sir.
Are you out of your Vulcan mind? No human can tolerate the radiation that's in there.
As you are so fond of observing, Doctor, I am not human.
You're not going in there.
Perhaps you're right. What is Mr. Scott's condition?
Well, I don't think that he...
I'm sorry, Doctor. I have no time to discuss this logically.
So how important was it for this to be Spock's death, but of course it wasn't, and how they finessed all that? And they were also getting a lot of media attention. There were spoilers. Even Johnny Carson told everyone that about that.
Yeah. Well, Spock's death was a big deal. You know, when the first Star Trek movie, the Star Trek motion picture, everyone hated it. It actually did okay commercially, you know, but it was so expensive and so boring, and the effects were really impressive, but it was lacking everything that Star Trek fans wanted in this, you know, long-awaited sort of reboot of the TV show that they had become such fans of. And so when that movie was considered a failure, Star Trek II, if it was going to happen, it really needed to connect. It really needed to succeed if they were going to keep, you know, the franchise going. And so what they did, Leonard Nimoy, the actor who played Spock, did not want to come back for a second movie. He didn't like the first movie. He had always had a love-hate relationship with the character. He felt like it was an albatross around his neck in some ways. He considered himself a serious actor, and he was. So he really needed to be wooed back if they were going to make this movie. That was the biggest sticking point in getting Star Trek II off the ground. And so what they did to sort of seduce him into being in the movie was they said, how would you like to have a great death scene? So if you're Leonard Nimoy and you hear that, you think, okay, this is a great acting challenge. I'll be rid of this thing.
All right, so let's go to listen to it. So did we lose the guest? No. All right, are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am.
All right, so Leonard Nimoy makes the decision. He's going to take the role. Gene Roddenberry, he's been kind of pushed off to the side. He seems to be the leaker who told the public that Spock was going to die in order to try to sabotage the film. But against Roddenberry's best efforts, this becomes some people say it's one of the best Star Trek movies ever.
I think it's the absolute best. And, you know, but people weren't happy about the Spock death. I mean, the studio got letters that said, if Spock dies, you die. and so it was, you know, when it finally happened, it was done so well that people actually applauded it.
And so you can see when you watch that final scene where Spock puts his hand on, does the mind meld with McCoy and puts his mind into McCoy. Was that done at the last second?
It was, yeah. The the producer wanted some sort of slightly ajar door to allow the possibility that Spock would return. So they created this sort of backdoor opening that, you know, with this mind meld moment that would potentially allow there to be a Star Trek III with Spock.
We're taking another break. Our phone line is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'd love to hear how you enjoyed these films when they first came out. Stay with us.
This is what it has come to.
Look! Out there! They're coming back!
Here is where it shall be decided.
Here it is.
Greetings from the Humongous.
In a world without gas.
The Humongous rules the wasteland.
I'm gravely disappointed that you wish to take the gasoline out of the wasteland.
Defend the fuel.
We'll never walk away.
Give me the pump, the gasoline. The whole compound.
This is a land that prays for a hero.
Well, if anyone's gonna get in there, it's...
12 men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to, but it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
You guys gonna listen to Gary? He can beat one of those things!
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. When we went to break, we heard part of the trailer for Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. And that is John Carpenter's The Thing trailer, was starring Kurt Russell. And we're speaking with Chris Nashawaty. He is the author of the book, The Future Was Now, where he tells the story of how these eight incredible sci-fi films came to be in that summer of 1982. So were these films of, you know, Mad Max, The Thing, were they big hits that time?
You know, surprisingly, not as much as you'd think. I mean, obviously E.T. was. That was a huge movie. Some did well, like the Star Trek movie, Wrath of Khan did well, Poltergeist did well. But some of the movies you'd expect to be hits weren't. Both The Thing and Blade Runner fared pretty poorly, both at the box office and with critics, which I found surprising because, you know, they've become such sci-fi parts of the sci-fi canon. They're considered classics now. But back then, they were sort of dismissed more than you'd think.
Right. Let's go to a caller. We have John on the line. And John, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you so much. I was wondering about the movie Tron. I was wondering if the author knew of any movies prior to Tron of any consequence that represented people in the form of software or people in a virtual world or represented software as people. And if the author feels that was that influenced later movies like The Matrix, or if there were still prior influences than Tron, for example.
That's a good question, John. Thanks for calling asking that question. So, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, the one that I can think of that best fits that description is what's the one where the people go into they're miniaturized and go into the human body and the blitz. Yes, that's the one that sort of feels the most technology sort of driven in that same way. But no, I mean, like, you know, in 1982, this was the era when home computing was just starting. You know, arcade games were the hot thing if you were a teenager, and maybe if you were older. I mean, this is really, these movies were made in a moment when technology was changing really, really quickly and in a revolutionary way. And Tron maybe a little bit ahead of its time. You know, it's a movie that didn't find the biggest audience, but it's a movie that really tapped into the technology of the moment and explored it.
Let's listen to a clip. This is the final scene, almost the final scene, of the film Blade Runner. Listen to
this. I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain. Time to die.
So, Chris, Blade Runner, also one of these films that did not do well at the box office, but upon, you know, opportunities with VHS and then later as things became digital, I guess it takes multiple viewings to really appreciate how great that film is and the performances.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it also depends which version of it you see. You know, when the movie came out in 1982, it's a complex movie. There's a lot going on in it, and you know, the original version that we all saw in the summer of 1982, that had a voiceover provided by Harrison Ford, somewhat reluctantly, but it made the movie a little bit more easier to follow. 10 years later, after the movie had failed at the box office, failed critically, but, you know, had slowly developed a bit of a cult audience, they re-released a different version, a version without the voiceover. That was the so-called director's cut that Ridley Scott wanted. And that version, while a little bit more difficult to understand, really changed the how people saw the movie and turned it into just a reevaluated sort of classic. So it took a very long time for people to embrace Blade Runner, but it, thank God, it eventually happened.
So do you think these films from 1982, that they have changed, you know, science fiction filmmaking, that these films, I mean, each and every one of them seem to have left an imprint?
Yeah, I really do. I mean, I think if you watch science fiction movies, you know, from any time over the past 30 years, you're really looking at, in most cases, not every case, but most cases, you're looking at a movie that sort of inherits its look from Blade Runner, for example. And I think that, you know, in terms of, you know, science fiction filmmaking, it was the boundaries of what Hollywood sci-fi films could be was really pushed and stretched in the summer of 1982. You know, a sci-fi movie could be a horror movie. A sci-fi movie could be, you know, an epic comic book movie. It could be, you know, a Star Trek movie. It could be a horror, straight up horror movie with gross special effects. It could be a heartwarming tale for kids. You know, it really showed how flexible the genre was. So I think to some degree, if we look at, you know, the movie landscape today, for better and for worse, we're sort of living in the world that the summer of 1982 created.
And did it change what Hollywood thought consumers would pay for? I mean, did it say, because before it was thought that the sci-fi was not a genre for major motion pictures. I mean, it didn't win the awards.
Right, right. And yes, I think, you know, Star Wars did that. I don't think that Hollywood, I think they recognized what happened with Star Wars. And they decided to follow the trail that movie blazed. And so they got into sci-fi movies and treated them with the artistic respect that they deserved. They weren't just, you know, the bottom half of a double feature anymore. They could be art. And I think that that's where we're at now. If you look at something like Dune, you know, Denis Villeneuve's two-part epic, that is a movie that, you know, feels like a direct descendant from the movies that we're talking about here.
Or The Three-Body Problem seems like that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if we're asking, like, why aren't films like this being made today, is your response, well, they are, they just, you know, they're coming to you in a different format. You don't go to the multiplex to, you know, watch them. They're coming to you in your home.
Well, yes, to some degree, that's true. That's true. But I also think that in a way they're not being made. I think that, you know, we live in a world where there are, everything's a sequel or a prequel or based on intellectual property. And, you know, the word franchise almost seems more important than the plot. And I think in 1982, these movies were all, some of them may have been based on books or whatever, but they were all bold and original, and Hollywood was at a crossroads and it was gambling its way out of the problem. Now I don't feel that the studios are taking the same risks. I think everything needs to have a proof of concept. Oh, it's related to this movie that's done well in the past. Everything feels like it's the product of an algorithm, you know, based on previous taste. And I don't know that that's necessarily where great creative decisions come from.
And so when you talk about films, you got to talk about the auteur theory, you know, the director and the director's hand in shaping these films. And it's their vision, particularly like, you know, The Thing is called, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing. How important, you know, and that's a remake from an older, you know, film, a way older film. So the directors here, you know, Steven Spielberg, you know, Ridley Scott, you know, how important were they for this?
I think hugely important. You know, it's one thing to know that, you know, you want to make a science fiction movie. It's another thing to actually transport people to what feels like the future. And I think all of these movies do that. You look at something like The Road Warrior, directed by George Miller. You know, it is as unique a vision as anyone could possibly come up with. The same with John Carpenter's The Thing. Yes, there had been another movie based on this short story written a very long time ago, but it has so much idiosyncratic sort of bold choices and interesting, you know, look and all of it, that, yeah, these are very, very strong, gifted filmmakers making statements and turning what had been perceived as a gutter genre into real art.
E.T., Tron, Star Trek, Wrath of Khan, Conan the Barbarian, Blade Runner, Poltergeist, The Thing, and Mad Max, The Road Warrior, all in the summer of 1982. We'll never have a summer like that again. And thank you so much for writing the book, The Future Was Now, Chris Nadawadi. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.